I hereby proclaim this the Summer of George. Welcome back, everyone, one and all. Thank you for joining us again for another episode of Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And today on the pod, it's just us chickens. Sometimes Ali and I find, although we, of course, love having our incredible guests on the show and learn tons by having them here, sometimes we feel like we are constrained in how much time we can yell at each other by the fact that we also have to let somebody else talk. And so we thought this week we would just take an hour or so to talk about all that's going on, because there is so much going on and so much is changing so fast. I don't know about you, Ali, but like, I cannot think of a time really in my life's history where I feel like each day is like a rapid toboggan ride down a hill of events. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The 24 hours, everything changes in 24 hours. It's crazy. And I'm absolutely loath to say it, but in many, many places, not everywhere, but in many places, things are looking rapidly better. And that is great, but also comes along with a whole bunch of complications that we'll start to talk about today. But let's start with something really cool that you, as usual, have done. God, I love you, man. You're so fucking...
Oh, I love you.
You get it done. You have an idea. You care about something. You're like, I'm not just going to sit on the fucking internet saying it. I'm going to go do something about it. God bless you, Ali Moman. You did your first pop-up musical event at a vaccination site this week. Tell us about it. How did it go? What was it like? Give us the rundown.
I'll tell you how it started. It started with the tweet. I just got to do it. And then basically people will come. And if you tweet it, they will come.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically, you know, I put it out on the socials and, you know, then I just got in touch with some people who heard it, who read it, and just the wheels really came in motion. But the thing that really dawned on me, and I mentioned this last week, it was like, what I basically need to do is I need to tell these people, listen, organizing a vaccine pop-up is crazy. And I said, listen, we got this. I know the last thing on your mind is literally like, oh, there should be some entertainment. I think they're probably thinking, let's just freaking vaccinate these people as quickly as possible and get it done. So I said, let me take that away from you. And so anyways, yeah, we showed up, tarp. It was raining like crazy, which was nuts. We got the sound system, the PA system. I had to get a generator to like plug in because I don't know if we were outside. So I went to Home Depot and it was just crazy stuff. It was fun though. It was really nice to do something outside your house. I will say that. And so we did it and we had two musicians. A friend of mine, Spencer from Come From Away, and he was playing the guitar, and his friend was playing the fiddle, and it was just like, it was good, it was hype, and you could see people in the audience like clapping, kind of like dancing a little bit, like it really brought a great spirit. And then the second we left, I get a call from the organizer saying, "Hey, you coming on Friday?" So you know, this thing is maybe spiraling beyond the depths of my ability to control. So I might need some help. So if anyone wants to like help me make this like a thing, I will just say this: as long as we make it simple for them, and these are skills that we have, we can be at as many vaccine pop-ups as possible.
So yeah, if you're out there and you want to help Ali organize this amazing idea of having musicians play at your pop-up vaccination, which is just so delightful and like hopeful and what life should be about, so good. Get in touch with him at Soft Revcast on Instagram, Twitter. We got softrevcast@gmail. Anyway, alimoman.com. Go check that out, because that brings me to the second thing I wanted to talk to you about this week, which is that a while back, you put out a video when you were first starting to run for the nomination. You put out a video about how we should be celebrating right now, how these vaccines were one of the great achievements in human history, that they were incredibly effective, that we had gotten them done in a space of 11 months, and that this is like a moonshot, and that we did it as a humanity, as a collective, as a group of people, as a group of scientists, we did it. And that you felt it was really important to take that moment and celebrate. And we didn't do that. No one did that. It didn't happen anywhere in the world, really. And especially in my view, it didn't happen here because of the complications around the rollout of the vaccine and because of the sense that we were sort of, you know, the FOMO around the whole thing in Canada. There has been this overriding sense of frustration, of confusion, of, you know, fear, because the rise of the third wave was vicious here. But no celebration and no sense of just how incredible this is, that we have arrived at this point where a shot in the arm is going to change our lives. So I just wanted to remind people, A, that Ali was on about this months ago, but B, what has happened to us? Why can't we understand how huge this is and how joyous this is? Listen, of course there's pain and sorrow all around us, and it has to be acknowledged, but we do nothing for those who suffer and those who have died by not recognizing how many lives are about to be saved by that which has been accomplished. And so I'm wondering for you, Ali, like, do you think we'll ever have that moment? And if we will, when's it going to happen? When's it coming?
It doesn't matter now. I want you to know I made that video, A, because I was like, guys, this is, again, freaking unbelievable. 4 safe and effective vaccines. And I also want to talk about this notion of, like, you know, variants are bringing down the efficacy of the vaccine. Yeah, for sure. And the vaccines will adapt and whatever. But don't forget even the standard that we first set. If you get over 50% efficacy, success. So yeah. Like, let's just step back again and realize how freaking unbelievable this is. And this is what I say to, like, you know, conspiratorial people who are many now and who many hold PhDs. I have conversations with people that, like, should know better, but they don't. And that's just what it is. I'm learning to accept it. But I go, maybe it isn't a conspiracy that they came so quick. Maybe, just maybe, it is a sign of how exceptional we are and not a sign of how conspiratorial we are, right? Let's just put that there. But the reason why we need to start celebrating these things is that if we do not get to 70 to 90% herd immunity around the world, this doesn't stop. So we need to, literally, it's a public health emergency now that we need to start celebrating these vaccines, and we have to start doing it. And the other thing we have to start doing is, we spoke about this, you know, laying out metrics. Australia did this. They actually said that, you know, when we get to cases at this level, we'll open up transit. When we get cases at this level, we'll open up, you know, theaters or whatever. Michigan is having this thing, vax to get back. No, I don't know what they said. Vax to open or something. Back to open plan, whatever. Personally, I'm a fan of the near rhyme of vax and back. I like it. Stephen Sondheim would hate it. He's proper rhyme,
it's
but whatever.
Strict rhyme.
Yeah, he whatever. But I like that near rhyme. It's very good. Listen, we got to do this.
Although
I don't care.
You know, he didn't ascribe to that always, because I'm just came
no,
to my
he,
mind.
No. Every, he has no near rhymes.
Every day a little death. In the parlor, in the bed. That's not a proper rhyme.
Oh my God.
Screw you, Sondheim. Fuck you, Stephen Sondheim.
What?
Anyway.
Okay, then he would love this. He's probably, like, amazing. But Michigan came out today and they said, look, when we get to 40%, we're going to do this. When we get to 70% plus 14 days of full vaccination, everything is over. We're done. We're done with this.
So this brings me to, like, there is a joy deficit, no doubt about it. And we got to bring back the joy. Like, we have to repay some of the joy lost. And I will talk a little later on about grief, because I think that's important too, especially for artists. But, you know, there is this huge amount of touring now of every kind being announced in the United States and in the UK, not here, because our government has given us zero guidance, zero timeline, zero understanding of where we stand.
Give it a month or two.
I don't want to give it a month or two.
A month or two because we are behind a month or two.
It doesn't matter. Two things should be able to be done at once. It is unconscionable that the Canadian government and that the provincial governments in this country have completely and utterly failed to talk to artists, to guide us through
this. This is why it should be about vaccination. This is why we got to stop doing dates. Don't do dates. Just say when we get to 50% vaccine, because that makes the most amount of sense.
Yes.
You don't know when something is going to happen, but you know what needs to happen. You know that when we're at 50% herd immunity, there are certain things that we can do. 60%, give people fucking benchmarks and metrics to get to things.
Because and then it's starting just pushes to happen. People. It's starting to happen around the world. Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, has just announced that New York City will fully reopen on July 1st. That means all businesses at 100% capacity, including Broadway, folks. So the world is moving on. And it is, I understand, you know, it's really hard, Ali, to look at that New York Times map every day of the color codes of which countries have the most numbers of cases per 100,000 people and see Canada for the first time a darker shade of red than the United States. Canada now has 21 cases per 100,000 people in the last 7 days. The United States has 16. And just to put it in perspective for everyone, India has only 26 cases per 100,000 people. So as appalling and terrible as what is happening is in India is, we're not far behind them on a per capita basis. That's how bad things have gotten here. So, you know, the amount of ground we have to make up and how far behind we are is scary. But as you always say, the change will be rapid. The turnaround will be incredible. It'll be whiplash time. By the end of May, by the end of June, as you've said many times, we will be where the UK
is. They just announced today in Ontario that as of May 24th, which is essentially less than a month away, anybody 18 and plus who wants a vaccine will be able to book a vaccine through the province.
Exactly.
We are getting that. The glut of vaccine is coming. And if you look at just like the rate of vaccination in Canada, it's like a hockey stick. It's going up. Soft Revolution is brought to you by Effin' Birds, a book and webcomic by our dear friend Aaron Reynolds. And as you know, it's not just a book. It's not just a webcomic. It is also a series of playing cards. And here, every week on Soft Revolution, I go into these deck of cards and I pull out a card and I read it to you. And today, we have... It looks like the... What is this? Oh, it's the Jack of Clubs. And it looks like a robin. I don't know. I'm not really a bird guy. But the robin is saying, go to the fucking library. You know, I think I might send this card to the Premier of Ontario. Because I think he could use some books to read. I think that would be good for him. Thank you to Effin' Birds for supporting Soft Revolution. Please go to their website, effinbirds.com. Get the book, get the webcomic. But if you're not going to do that, follow them on social media. Thanks again to Effin' Birds.
So this leads me to my point, which is if we don't have a plan, not just for the economic sector of Canada, but in particular, as it pertains to this podcast, for the cultural sector of Canada, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Imagine being Anthony Cimolino right now. What the fuck's the guy supposed to do? He's got this season planned. Right now, you can't even, you know, be in a playground. Dougie Ford says you're going to get COVID in a playground. There's no plan. There's no it's absolute reaction all the time. It's never proactive. There has never been benchmarks set. We continue to allow our public health officers to completely govern policy, which is ridiculous because there are multifaceted things happening inside this pandemic. It is not just a medical crisis, as we've said a million times. There's crises happening in all kinds of ways, and experts from different areas need to have a say in how policy happens. I don't get it, man. And all I can account for it is by saying that Canada is seeing the real severe limitations of a parliamentary system within a country that has this much geographic distance between regions. Does that make sense to you?
I saw, was it you or no, it was Nestro who did this Confederacy tweet saying about, you know, the provinces and how it's just like, what, you know, messed up. I really do think that things are going to change very quickly. We are in a difficult situation now. And it sucks, and we are here because of terrible decisions in the past. All this information was presented to us. Actually, vaccines are coming faster than even was directed by Trudeau. So, you know, anybody who's running a province should have known better. And the only provinces that have really done well, continue to do well, are the Atlantic provinces.
Well, so, it's interesting, you know, because all this and the stuff is being announced in the States. And I mean, the UK has been a little more specific about what exactly might happen. But in the States, in classic American style, it looks like people are just like, damn the torpedoes, let's book some shows. And none of it, except on a state by state or city by city basis, really has any kind of guidance. So in other words, these venues are selling shows at capacity. And they aren't in the distant future. You know, some of them are coming up in June. I've seen tours booked in June in the States. So it'll
be really crazy, brother, what happens in America.
Well, yeah. And what happens in America and to what extent that will dictate what happens in terms of how live performance of all kinds comes back all over the world, particularly in Canada, right? So if the rollout in the States is bold, and it so far it seems to be, and you know, Biden's speech last night, and we'll talk a little bit about that, seemed to kind of be a proclamation of, if not the end of the pandemic, certainly the final moments of it. So if that is how the United States is heading into the summer and fall, you have to wonder how long the Canadian cultural consumer is going to tolerate not having the same opportunities, right? Like there will begin to be a real pressing urgency in terms of people like Live Nation or the Mervishes or anybody who's booking big tours, big shows, to answer the question, when and how many and are we doing this? And so I have to believe there are conversations going on behind the scenes. And I wish that there was a journalist out there who would go and find out what those conversations were and get somebody on the record and get somebody, even if they're on background, just get a source and find out why the Canadian government and all of the provinces seem completely to have forgotten that art exists. It's incredible to me. But if there is a plan, you have to believe that it's going to change in correspondence to what the United States does. I mean, it's very much a, like, if an elephant rolls over and you're a mouse, get the hell out of the way kind of scenario. Yeah. So there's a lot of uncertainty.
The money that, you know, the Canadian government has given, which has actually been a lot for the arts recently, but it is very much geared towards first the Digital Now project, but there has been extra money, particularly in the budget, for live venues, hundreds of million dollars for concerts, or all that, the live music industry and stuff. But I don't want to be I don't know. Listen, you know, in January 2020, I read about a virus in Wuhan, and I started to read some preprint studies, and I saw that it was airborne, and I saw that it was asymptomatic. And I went to management, I come from away, and I said, what's the plan? And there wasn't one. And I asked some people in government, and I said, what's the plan? And they said there wasn't one. I don't want to be like Mr. Worry Worry here, but I think America at only 50% vaccination saying, F it, that's not good. Because that is how the virus is going to mutate again. And that is how it's going to break through vaccines. I had a conversation with our friend Alan Detsky today, and we were talking about this. And we have to crush this virus. If we do not crush this virus, everything will be temporary.
Isn't it
everything we do will be momentary?
Isn't it just too late, though? I mean, isn't it ultimately too late to do that? Is the cat not out of the bag at this point? And it seems to me that, yes, in principle,
No, but I think in Canada we can, as opposed to America.
But we have the longest land border on Earth. We have this giant border,
sure,
and we have...
That's fine, but we don't have Fox News. We don't have, you know, OAN. We don't have Newsmax. It's more feasible and possible for us to get to 70 to 80% herd immunity. And then basically, if anyone wants to come in from the States, you have to show your vaccination papers, or you need to take a test or
something
like that.
You don't think the United States will get to 70%, even if you take into account that 30% of them have natural immunity from having had the thing?
No.
I'm really worried.
If you look at Republican states, you look at South Dakota, you have Joe Rogan telling, you know, 21-year-olds not to get the vaccine. And I will say, I had an issue with... it wasn't Jen Psaki, but it was the White House spokesperson was on TV, and she was like, well, people shouldn't get their news from Joe Rogan. Well, I don't think he knows anything about science. It's like, no, stop. Millions of people listen to this guy. So take it at face value and make a proper argument as to why a 21-year-old should get it. don't just like shame people. Have we not learned yet? So all I'm saying right now is that it is of like, it is so important that we do everything we can to first get our own country and then make sure to get the rest of the world to 70 to 80 to 90%, because otherwise we are going to be doing this dance forever and everything becomes momentary. And I was reading this other study that was sent to me looking at just some modeling. And if this continues, if we don't get to 70, 80, 90% all around the world or the places in which you want people coming in, we're going to be like having to social distance again. We're going to be having it being, having to shut things down again for moments and periods and stuff like that. And that's really tough for our industry. So,
okay. So let me play devil's advocate here, because sure. I do recognize the truth of what you're saying. If everything is uncertain, then surely possibly the only response to that is to move ahead like the best of all possible worlds will be. And I think that that is something that, in terms of how you make a plan as a cultural organization or as an artist or as an entrepreneur in the cultural sector, in terms of how you make a plan, at this point for me, I don't see any other way of moving forward. Because
yeah, yes, just like planning, just go forward.
All that that you say is entirely true, but we can't live in a world where this doesn't end. And so even if the ending is false, you then have to make a plan upon that potentially false ending and adjust when you get there and find that indeed it was false, because there is no other way, as we have discussed so often, to make an economic model work for the cultural sector without full rooms, without people jammed up against each other. We can't make it work. And it doesn't matter how many government programs they will throw at us. Eventually, those subsidies are going to end. Eventually, we're going to have to be at a place where we're like, okay, this is the end of the industry unless we live in hope. And so to me, that is why I think there has to be a certain amount of putting blinders on right now, making a plan and attempting to stick to it. And I know that that's what people are doing. That's why these tours are being booked. That's why Stratford and Shaw have made a season. That's why people are making plans. But you're absolutely right. We don't know. Maybe we'll see COVID-19, like viruses have before, kind of peter out. Or maybe it will ramp up and a new variant will evade vaccines and we'll be screwed and we'll be social distancing. But at this point,
we'll have to keep on making new. It's just, I'm saying it's like, it's just going to constantly be a part of our lives.
There's going to be
people who are down for it. People who are like, I'm getting my booster this year. You know what I'm saying? But yep. There are also going to be a large swath of people, even in places like Canada, you know, where they're going to be like, forget it.
But
we have to keep the ball in the air.
Societal norms will push people eventually towards vaccination. And we will, even in these states, get to that 70, 80. But this is the thing, is that what you're seeing happen in the states is not happening here. And it's not happening because we're not far enough along the vaccine road, but it's also not happening here. We have to accept this about ourselves, Ali, because we are a timid country and we don't have a lot of unity and we don't have a lot of common purpose and narrative. And it's revealed this whole thing, how ruinous the whole system of the provinces having so much power can be. Because if you have a bad premier, it doesn't matter who's in power in Ottawa. If Doug Ford's in charge of half the fucking population, we are screwed, right? And from a cultural perspective,
A lot of people go like, well, you know, how did UK get all those vaccines, blah, blah, blah. And I go, you know, it's called the NHS.
Yeah.
National.
It's the National Health Service.
It's not called CHIP here.
That's right. It's not called Vancouver Coastal and Fraser Health and Interior Health and all these things. And so
civics, please teach civics.
We as a country have allowed ourselves to be fragmented, and that, you know, we've also, I think, we have to accept that we don't really give a shit about culture in this country. As a group, hockey is the only thing we share as a cultural entity.
And basketball now, yeah.
And basketball. But, you know, this place has a lot of fracturing, a lot of separation in it. We have the Quebec issue. We have the Alberta issue. We have our complete lack of ability to reconcile with First Nations, with the North. We're very separated, man. And so when this virus came along and you saw how little national unity could be assembled around the fight against it, you know, how do we get back from that? I don't know.
In the beginning, there were literally pieces, you know, comparing us to America in international news, talking about how in the beginning, all the provinces worked together. We were together. Now, I will say this, because everyone likes to say, oh my God, Doug Ford was so amazing in the beginning of March 2020. And I always repeat, and I said, we were amazing.
Right.
We were amazing.
Right.
We stayed the F home. We. I'll never forget that. We. So it was definitely there. But you're making a good point, because I step back here and I go, wait, but yeah, we don't have the conservative media. We don't.
Like, no.
I think America is more polarized than Canada, but I am seeing the beginnings of polarization.
But it's not so much polarization in this country as it is an inability to consolidate, you know? It's this...
Right, to do the big things.
We have always floated on the notion that somehow, you know, we just get away with it, whatever it was, how we dealt with First Nations or how we dealt with Quebec or the slow motion collapse of the healthcare system or whatever it is. We have been a smug, careless country with very little unity. And so when this disease reduced us and made us feel how important it is to have that sense of national effort, we really didn't know where to begin. And we have a minority government in power. And so there is no sort of consensus even in Ottawa. And yeah, there are things I love about the parliamentary system. That stasis, that inertia also means that we don't end up with a Donald Trump with unchecked power, right? Like this is, but we also don't end up with a Joe Biden. So, you know, let's get to Joe Biden, because this old man is
you were not a fan, bro.
Listen,
I'll never forget, but hey, I like Joe. I always like Joe.
This old fart is really stepping up. But last night he gave, and I'm not sure, maybe you can explain to me why it wasn't called a State of the Union address. He gave a speech to the joint session of Congress, which for some reason,
so he was invited by the Speaker of the House, which is generally what happens.
Uh-huh.
Now, it is in the Constitution that at every year that the president does come and give the State of the Union. That is something that happens. But under certain circumstances, usually it's just become a norm that after the first 100 days, the Speaker of the House invites the president to make an address. The last time it happened outside the 100 days was, I think, Obama in 2009, when he was pushing the healthcare plan.
Uh-huh.
Pelosi invited him to come and speak about healthcare.
So,
or let's say, remember after September 11th, when you know, after that George Bush came out, that again, basically the Speaker can invite the president anytime. So if the Speaker really wants to, like, you know, piss off the president, be like, hey, you're coming, I'm inviting you, you know, and it could be on like an important day to piss him off.
So Biden did this in order to bolster his new policies, his bill that he is trying to pass through Congress. I think it's $4 trillion of spending to revitalize the American economy. It's not a lot compared to what they spend on weapons every year. I mean, it's, you know, this is constantly the thing, is like, the United States spends so much money on defense that everything pales in comparison. But let's talk about it as we always do, as is our obligation, as is our wont on this show, as a piece of theater, because man, oh man, what, talk about two different movies. If you think back a year ago to what a typical Donald Trump State of the Union speech felt like in the world, and what it did to the news cycle, and what it did to policy and to culture, and now you look at what Joe Biden has done, it is truly kind of astonishing that the same nation could be in those two states that close together. There was an article today in the Times about, you know, or in Politico actually, about Joe Biden bringing in the whisper as a new political tactic, you know, that literally the more important what he's saying is, the quieter he says it. In terms of just theatrical style and performance style, you're seeing such radical difference, right? Nearly 80-year-old man with a speech impediment, who is granddad-like, avuncular in every way, who kind of whispers, you know, bromides to you like he's sitting beside your bed in the First World War and you've got a bandage around your head.
Folks,
as opposed to that bleating, orange amphetamine-laced lunatic. I mean, it is so crazy, man, to see the two styles. What did you think of Biden's speech last night? And what do you make of this new American approach to global influence, which is, you know, talk softly and carry a big stick, apparently?
I think he's skating to where the puck is going. And I think it's definitely a presidency that knows that it's only going to be 4 years. I think there are definitely things that he's just really not thinking about in ways that other politicians would. You know, it's actually crazy. He has no F's to give. You know, when he came out and he was like, white, you know, supremacism. What? White? Say that word for me?
Supremacy.
Supremacism?
Yes, oh, supremacism.
Is that a word? Jen Lena going to come kick
supremacy.
My ass. No.
I think supremacy will do.
Yeah, white supremacy. That's it. But basically, like, that is the number one form of terrorism we have right now. All pun intended there. But crazy stuff. And then, you know, it's just crazy. Kamala Harris in the back and Nancy Pelosi in the back. And it's just like, yes, it was amazing. But again, I'm just like, holy smokes. There is going to be a large swath of crazy in America that this is going to piss them off.
Because I think part of what Biden's strategy that is kind of brilliant is you don't see the guy, you know, and I think they are following.
But you feel his policies.
You feel the policies, but it's policy forward. It's not personality forward. In fact, it's personality in the very rear. And I think it's kind of genius. I think what he's doing is following the logic that if you give fuel to the media fire, they will burn that fuel. And if you don't give fuel to the media fire, they'll go find someone else to burn. They'll go burn Chrissy Teigen or whoever is the outrage of the day. Mm. And so, you know, whereas Trump was functioning and sort of keeping his presidency and his movement alive on this constant feeding of the media's desire for controversy and for negativity, Biden seems to be entirely starving that fire. And I think it's going out. I mean, this may seem like not good news, but Joe Biden's speech last night was the lowest rated speech in like 20 years. To me, that says...
And that's great. I think it's great.
I think it is great because I think it's people are not hate watching it, and they're not watching it to sort of see which side of the fence that they are on. And
I don't watch CNN anymore. I don't care.
Exactly. I don't listen to Pod Save America anymore. I think there's a whole bunch of partisanship and there's a whole industry, a whole economy around that conversation. And now that has been now recentered around COVID, that is desperate to stay alive and will jump from one divisive controversy to the next. But when you have a presidency who refuses to engage in that, I think you find yourself in a very difficult position if you're trying to keep those kind of arguments going. So, yeah, he can walk on stage and quietly announce that he's just going to try and enact the most radical agenda since 1946. And people are kind of yawning at it because it's all in the details, right? It's actual policy. It's not just throwing shit at a wall to see if it sticks.
Here's what I'm surprised about, though, because he, you know, you are right. And this is something that he said. He goes, I'm going to define bipartisanship with what is popular. So I don't care that, you know, 50 or 49 Republicans are going to vote against this thing that is like, is the sky blue just because of partisanship? Like, I don't care. That to me is not how I define it. I'm just going to define it by what the population thinks. And the population is for that COVID relief bill. You know, as he said, he goes, money in pockets, shots in arms. And then now this infrastructure bill, like, people are all for it. They're like, yeah, let's rebuild the country. Sounds like a great time. And, you know, jobs. The one thing I don't understand, and I'm waiting for him to do it. And Andrew Yang said this thing about Joe Biden. Joe Biden, I think because he's an old white dude that's been around forever, has this uncanny ability to, you know, put out something revolutionary and it seems centrist. Mm-hmm. Okay, if those two things are true, if Joe Biden says whatever and it seems, hey, like your grandpa says, you know, we should do this, sounds like a good time. And if Joe Biden views bipartisanship with what is popular, what the F is up with his stance on marijuana? Why isn't he legalizing and saying we are going to legalize marijuana? He would be the most popular president ever. So I kind of wonder what's up with that. Because, you know, there's been some issues in that administration in which they prevented certain people from working who admitted to using marijuana.
Yeah, I think you're poking there at some really at a really big bruise. And I think it, you know, once you open that up, you can talk about all kinds of things. I think there is a Puritanism at the heart of progressive, of the progressive movement right now, that is not dangerous, but not helpful, and not politically smart. Mm. And I think you can find that Puritanism in kind of COVID absolutism, in hygiene theater, in the San Francisco school board's decision to continue to keep schools closed, even though there are presently under 10 people in hospital in San Francisco with COVID-19. You can see over the last, and I don't know whether Trump was the cause of this. I think he did have a large amount to do with it, but there seems to be a creeping sense of moral certainty in the progressive movement, which centers around health, that I think is going to play extremely badly, not just to the American people, but to the Canadian people. So when you start to judge people about their habits, about what they eat or what they, you know, drive or what they consume in general, you are A, missing your real target, which is the corporations that produce these harmful things and make massive profits off of them and go to great lengths to lie to the audience that they're selling it to in advertisements in order to get them to buy it. But you also alienate people immediately and make them start to feel like you are scolding them. And the marijuana thing, I think, is an attempt to be morally consistent, even though it kind of seems to be against what you would think of as the Democrats' core constituency. And, you know, I would think that more Democrats have smoked marijuana in their life than Republicans, but maybe that isn't so. Maybe we have missed that kind of puritanical streak in the left over the last 20 years, and it needs to be examined, and I think it needs to be excised, because it is not smart politics, man. You start to get into how people spend their private time, it's a slippery fucking slope. As Pierre Trudeau said in 1971, the government has no role in the bedrooms of the country, and the government has no role in whether you smoke a joint or not, or whether you drink, and frankly, in my opinion, whether you do drugs. So this whole question, I think, is just another kind of petard we can hoist ourselves on if we choose to as progressives. It's very dangerous, and I wish people would get smart about it. It's craziness. It's crazy to let the right have
that. I think it's personal with Biden. There's something with marijuana and Joe Biden.
Well,
and
he's even very said much recently, of that generation,
old.
Right?
He's old. This is the one thing where I'm just like, he's just old.
Yeah.
Somebody give him a joint. Give him an edible.
And
come
when
on.
He, you know, I read a big article about him when he was running, and he was a real square, right? He grew up in the 60s. I mean, he was a youngish man in the 60s, and everyone around him was experimenting with drugs and growing their hair out and all that. And his brand all along has kind of been, hey, I'm Joe from Scranton, you know, and I'm just a straight shooting guy who happens to think that, you know, people deserve a fair shake, and all that kind of Jimmy Stewart stuff is not just a put on. He really is married to it as a personality. He's incapable to some degree. And oddly enough, I also think Obama had that in him. Obama was a reformed, you know, hippie. Obama did do drugs in college and, you know,
Obama was restrained by his blackness.
He was Obama restrained, was by, his restrained blackness, by his blackness, but I also because think he couldn't had say a certain, it. But he has a certain moralistic tone about him as a person. He, you know, he's a religious man. He's a man of faith. Tony Blair as well. There is this school on the left of moderate left wing, sort of a little bit peevish, a little bit sort of curtain twitching. And I wish it would stop, because I think ceding that kind of territory, like basic individual human right to enjoy yourself in whatever way you want, ceding that stuff to the right, big mistake. And I've said that about masking as well, and about our hygiene theater and all these things. We have to be brave in order to get back to normal. And we cannot just give in to ridiculous over weaning illogical public health hygiene theater. And it's, you know, it's going to happen, but it's going to be infuriating. And we should fight against it at every turn, because as people who are trying to make their living off live performance, if we let people be paranoid and unreasonable about safety in the coming years, we're going to live to regret it for decades to come.
Now until May 15th. This week at Crow's Theater, check out Here We Are by Aaron Shields. Here We Are is many things: a book, a play, an audio recording, and it can all be experienced for free at crowstheater.com. Governor General award-winning playwright Aaron Shields created Here We Are, an unstoppable outpouring of words, thoughts, and emotions to help make sense of the upheaval of the world she experienced over the past year. Featuring music by Thomas Ryder Payne and book design by Alfred Mulroy. Don't miss it.
So I don't know, man. It's I really hope we're getting that message out there.
I was looking at like a bunch of people, like obviously everybody walking around with a mask. And I'll never forget the first time I put a face mask on in March. And I felt like weird. Mm-hmm. It was so weird. I was like, what is this thing? It's just weird. But I don't care now. Now I'll walk around. I got the KN95. I'm feeling good. And, you know, we're going to enter a world in which we're going to look out at audiences for a period of time, and they're going to be wearing their masks. There's an article in the New York Times about, you know, Israel and their kind of post-vaccination future. And there's vaccine passports and there's distancing and their masks inside kind of shows. And then there's certain restaurants where you take it off, but you have to show a pass. And how are you going to feel like going out into an audience, let's say, of like masked up people? Do you care?
I'll say to you what you've said to me so often, which is the virus is going to tell us what to do. So I know, but
for that brief period, like, are you going to go out and see an audience full of masked people and be like,
you know,
like,
what I'm going to feel? I think this is a very personal thing, but for me, I don't care what they've got on. I'm just going to be excited to see them, you know? Yeah. So for me, I think there is, as our friend who wrote to us a couple of weeks ago said, I think there is value. There is some demonstrative value in hygiene theater if it makes people feel safe returning to a behavior that we have left behind for a year and a half. So to me, that is constructive. Like, I don't see how you don't have at least half the audience wearing masks at theaters. Certainly theaters, which have an older demographic, right? For the next year to 2 years. And you might see a small minority of people in the theater audience do that forever now, just the way you do in Japan and Korea and all kinds of places in the world. There are people who choose to wear masks in public. It's about, you know, this is totally my just back of a napkin. I've been to Japan 3 times estimation, but walking through the streets of Tokyo, I would say between 3 and 5% of people wear masks in public, right? Yeah. In Tokyo. I think that will be true here now too. And I think in many ways that will be a good thing, because I think there's a lot of people who are vulnerable, who have, you know, immune deficiencies, who have chronic illnesses, who will now feel less.
Or you just don't want to get sick.
Yeah, but those people, those people will feel less othered. They will feel less uncomfortable because there will be people around them who do it. Instead of being the only person in a room wearing one, you might be one of 5 or 6 people in a room wearing one.
I might wear a mask on every like packed public. If I walk on a public, I'll have a mask in my pocket and I walk in and I see this goddamn, you know, bus is packed, I might put a mask on. Yep. And it's not because I'm trying to avoid the coronavirus. At that time, I'm going to have like 20 vaccines inside me. I'm taking them all, you know?
Yep.
But for me, it's going to be like, you know what? I don't want a regular cold.
But let me finish my point. My point is, yes, I'd be happy to see that. Yeah. But if there were, you know, 2 coronavirus deaths a week in Canada, and coronavirus existed on a level that was lower than the flu at any given moment, and they still wanted me to wear a mask inside, I would call bullshit on that. And that would upset me a great deal. Because at that point, we are legislating and we are enforcing infringements on basic rights that we never, ever tried to infringe upon before.
Now let me play devil's advocate, Torque. If all of a sudden, let's say there is, you know, another situation like this, or it is COVID, but it's a variant or something, and they say, look, you know, we have 10, 20 cases, but for just a week or two, we need to go back to certain public health measures. would you do it? Because we talk about, and I say, hitting this bad boy early and hard for a short period of time is always the way to go.
Absolutely. I would do it, but here's, I would do it with a caveat, which is I would do it if our governments were in a position to do it properly. So let this be the final lockdown with no paid sick leave. Let this be the final fucking lockdown where people cannot get rapid testing. Let this be the final lockdown where we don't have a plan to return kids to school safely. Enough of this bullshit of just improvising our way through another lockdown. Oh, Costco, you know, put some yellow tape over the shaving cream because it's not essential. Absolute fucking useless nonsense.
We're all tired
of it. So if there was actual protocols put in place and there was a real public conversation and everyone came to the table and had an actual plan and we dealt with the reality that, as you've said, there will be other pandemics, there will be other viruses, this may mutate in such a way that we all have to lock down again. Absolutely. I don't want people dying. I want a happy, healthy, free society. But free is important. It's incredibly important. And if we cede the ground of natural freedom being really important to a bunch of anti-vax, anti-mask lunatics, we are really, really doing a disservice to our movement. Because we should be defending people's right to move freely, to gather freely, and to enjoy each other's company. And there are all kinds of reasons why we haven't been able to do that for the past year. But when the science leads us towards the truth that we can, when the numbers drop and the virus tells us it's safe to do that stuff, we have to be passionate in our defense of it. Yeah. And it is, as I've said last week, our moral responsibility, all of us, to be as brave as we possibly can, to keep our mask on whenever we feel safe doing so, to keep our mask off whenever we feel safe doing so, and to put our mask on when we feel like it's considerate to other people. It's going to be subtle. It's going to be nuanced. None of us are very good at that. You know, risk assessment in this society, I mean, I hate to tell everyone, but like your passion for bacon, which seems to be something that just is shared by the entire carnivorous.
I had a baconator yesterday, man.
Yeah, like so meat good. Eaters really seem to agree on one thing, whether they're Rush Limbaugh lovers or they're Ali Momin lovers. You guys love bacon. But I got a newsflash for you. That shit gives you cancer. It's been proven.
It's bad, yeah.
So like, okay, go ahead and eat it. But don't tell me, you know, that I then can't do something that you think is bad mm-hmm. for my health. This is the thing that we get into. Of course, the giant exception with COVID is it's contagious. And so we have to look after each other. We can't just protect ourselves. We have to protect other people. But even that has a line. Even that has a line. Otherwise, society as we know it just doesn't exist. If we wanted to protect other people, absolutely, we would not drive cars. If we wanted to protect absolutely other people, we would never leave our homes. And we can't live like that.
Our future is going to look like South Korea. Our future is going to look like South Korea.
In what sense do you mean that?
Well, South Korea handled this virus like very, very well. And that's because they went through SARS-1 and then they went through MERS. And they built like an infrastructure, an apparatus around basically living with potential pandemics. And they, you know, there's a country of 57 million people. There was recently 761 cases. I love it. People come to me and say, like, oh yeah, Ali, was South Korea locked down? And I'm like, what's the population of South Korea? Right. But they don't know. And I tell them 57 million. And then if they knew, they wouldn't be doing this thing. Yeah. And then I tell them, look, they locked down at 761 cases. That's when they locked down. They locked down for a brief period of time, or they have crazy tracing, like you said, you know, in which they could isolate exactly where it is. They keep the threshold low. They like close down this area for like just a week or two. Like that's ultimately, I think, where we're going to go. And, you know, South Korea has a huge culture scene. They have a huge live music scene. They have this whole time Phantom of the Opera was going down in South Korea. It would shut down for a day or two there, but then it would come back up again. Like, I think for a period of time, like, I would really love us to be like South Korea. But I will say one of the reasons South Korea is South Korea is that people say, okay, okay, mm-hmm. okay, we're doing this. Okay. And it's like such a big part of the game. Like, you know, it was so hard to get everyone to get that stupid COVID alert app, which is just so, you know, how Chris Skye, crazy anti-vaxxer, you're literally on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, yet you won't get this app. Come on.
We're going to wrap this up, but I wanted to talk briefly. You know, we started with a conversation about the joy deficit and how we should be celebrating these incredible vaccines. 2 cases in Prince Rupert last week, Ali, from 100 cases a week to 2. Unbelievable. Wow. Because they vaccinated 85% of the population. But I do want to end by pointing out that I also think it's important that we as artists, and I know there's a lot of you out there listening and there's a lot of art lovers, that we mourn what we've lost. You know, now let's put aside the much more intense and real mourning of people who've lost loved ones. That is a massive, massive thing, and comparisons are odious. I'm talking about what we've lost as workers. Mm. And it's not the same as lives lost, of course not. But I think moving on from this, certainly for me, and I think for all of us as artists, will involve acknowledging how much has been lost. All the shows never seen or performed, you know, all the nights out, all the moments that change people's lives, all those little smiles you put on people's faces at home from home away or come from away, or all those tears that people shed at a beautiful opera. You know, all that shared laughter and joy and catharsis, that deficit is not an insignificant abstract thing. It's an incredibly real thing. It's hours and moments of everyone's time, of everybody in this society's lives that weren't lived. And like I said, you know, people get used to everything. That's one of our talents as an animal, as a species. We get used to suffering and we get used to change and we get used to deprivation. So yeah, this society is now getting used to living without art. It really is. You can feel it. It's just kind of fading away from people's lives. But it has no idea how much it's losing by getting used to that. So I think all of us as artists should take the time in the next few weeks, maybe on your vaccine day, maybe this is a good thing to do along with getting vaccinated, is sit down and write down the things you've lost, the jobs you didn't do, the moments you didn't have with your friends, the projects that went unfinished. Write them down and then burn that shit. Get a lighter out and let it go. And recognize that the things we make in the future from this day on are things that could not have been made without this last year happening, right?
That's true.
That the gift of this terrible thing is real. Like every terrible thing that happens to you, it contains gifts and opportunities that we now have a chance to utilize. And so the art that we all make going forward will be informed by how hard it was to let go of the things we didn't make and how difficult it was to live with the uncertainty of not making a living or not knowing where our next job was coming from. And we couldn't have made those things without this suffering. So the grief kind of leads you towards some kind of hope, you know? And for me, that's where I have to live right now. I have to acknowledge that this has sucked and I've lost a lot, but I know that 5 years from now, I'll look back and be like, man, if that had never happened, I never would have done this thing that meant so much to me, you know?
Yeah.
And that is the way
I definitely feel that
life works. You know, well, look at you. I mean, you're in that situation exactly, right? You're doing something that you may never have done had this moment not happened. So
I wonder though, because we should have one day, I want to have a conversation about intuitive thinking and why intuition is so necessary in life. And that's why artists are amazing, because we see things and yes, we see the data, but we don't go, well, let me just wait for more data. We're like, okay, I see it. Okay, right. I get it. And we go boom, right into the future. And I don't know. I need to think about this, but I wonder if just a part of me earlier on, more than others, was really cognizant of how much this changed everything. Mm-hmm. In February, I was walking into dressing rooms and come from away going like, guys, we're shutting down.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, no, Ali, you're not. I'm like, guys, we're shutting down. And then in March, I remember walking and talking to some people in the cast. And at first, I was like, oh, maybe we'll come back in the summer. And then I was like, no. Wait a second.
No, this is impossible. Years of your life.
Yeah. How do we do it? How is it literally possible to like convene 1,000 people in a room again? Like, guys, what? So I think for me, a lot of it came from, and I think it's something that is important, is to, man, this was big.
Yeah.
And my intuition told me how big it was. And I will continue again. And this isn't to say like give up art. No, not at all, man. This is amazing. It's not that. But I still want people to recognize that it will never be a light switch. Mm-hmm. It is not going to be a light switch, and that the world has changed forever. And you could just even see it recently. Google, they had their quarterly earnings. Apple had their quarterly earnings. Amazon is releasing them at 4 p.m. as we record today. Facebook, huge beats. Huge. Exceeded all expectations. The world has changed. But art has always been there. And it's really important for us to be like nimble and agile and really start to like go inside your intuition and think like, okay, what are we going to do? What is it going to look like? Because we are going to be necessary and there are ways for us to thrive, but we need to really recognize just how
profound this is. Well, frankly, the rise of Apple and Google and Facebook and all those things is an even more reason to continue to be an artist, because someone has to stand in the face of that huge monolith of big tech. You know, there has to be an argument for the human body in a room with other human bodies making noise and changing lives. And like, that's fundamental, you know?
I think theater, I think concerts, I think, you know, really crazy stuff that involves actual human beings around each other is going to be huge. I think haunted experiences, I think being able to perhaps, you know, like sleep no more kind of experiences. Yep. I think those things that cannot be done through a screen in any way are going to be huge. I think we are also probably going to get to a peak of like TV. We're going to hit its peak soon. Yeah. There's simply too many shows.
Yeah.
There's too many shows and there's only a finite amount of time in a day.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's crazy. And I'll tell you something. This is my guess. I think a lot of people bullshit about shows they've seen. I think a lot of people are like, yo, have you seen this? Oh, yeah, man. I loved it. So good. So good. Because you're like, you know what? Like, yeah, fuck it. I saw it.
Well,
sure.
You have to be able to be part of the conversation, right? You can't just sit there and not have anything to say about the words of the day.
Yeah. Anyway, but one day someone's going to be like, hey, I went to this like inside this like gallery and like they were doing, it was like this mixed media thing. Like there was art and there were people and there's people dancing and it was like, oh, wow, that's so cool. That is what I'm talking about.
Let's hope so. From your lips to God's ears, Ali Moman. Okay, that's the pod for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Next week, Ali, who we have in next week?
I've lost track of our schedule. I hate Twitter. I mean, I love Twitter, but you meet amazing people on Twitter. And there is somebody, if you're in like Toronto, you know Karima Saad. She is a lawyer, an arts activist, a political cartoonist. She is like a polymath. She is an every woman. I am like such a fan of this person. And her thing is that she uses humor and her intelligence to kind of like get through this thing. And lately she goes and she follows every anti-mask protest kind of in Toronto. And she videotapes these people and she's like famous to them. Like she knows them. And her big antagonist right now is Mr. Chris Skye, that crazy tatted guy that, you know, goes around and he's equating himself to Terry Fox. So he started up and whatever.
Jesus
but
Christ.
I'm so excited to talk to her because man, she knows how to do it. And I want to talk to her about like how she uses not just art, but humor to like survive.
Yep.
I'm so excited for her. You
gotta laugh.
So please check it out.
Next week on Soft Revolution. Listen, as usual, we would love you to join our Patreon, mostly because we love you and we want to give you more of what you like about Soft Revolution, but also because by doing so, you support the AFC, the Actors Fund of Canada, who are there for arts workers when they need them most. It is a fund which simply gives money to artists and arts workers who need it in times of desperation. I think that pretty much includes almost every single person in the arts right now. So it is more timely and more important as an organization than ever. And 1/3 of all our Patreon money in perpetuity will be going to the AFC. So please join us on Patreon or get in touch with us at Soft Revcast on Instagram, on Twitter, on Gmail, you name it. There's all kinds of ways of letting us know how you're feeling and what you're thinking, and we'd love to hear from you. Allie, what's your art pick this week?
Toni Morrison, her first book, Bluest Eye, which is brilliant. Just unbelievable. Yeah, just read it. It's about
brilliant book.
A black girl post-depression who, you know, obviously feels inferiority. She's in, you know, and she just strives to have blue eyes. And it's
You may find this hilarious, Allie. I was the only white guy in the African Studies department at the University of Toronto in 1990 when I went there. And I had the opportunity to read a lot of Morrison during that time. And she's one of my favorite writers. It's as close to me as music can get in writing. You know, the lyricism is the rhythm and the lyricism of her writing is such that it gives you a very similar feeling to what it's like to listen to music or even to make music.
Oh, yeah.
She's a genius. Oh, yeah. Read Toni Morrison. My pick this week is a very cool record that I want you to listen to, Allie, because I think it will be a good chill out album for you. There's a guy who calls himself Floating Points. He's a UK electronic artist who's been around for a while, amazing DJ, amazing electronic artist, and very influenced by 70s R&B and soul. And he has teamed up with the London Symphony Orchestra and the absolutely incredible legendary saxophonist Pharoah Sanders for a really, really beautiful album of instrumental music called Promises. And it starts with a single theme and then moves through six or seven movements, which just kind of turn this theme around the way you would turn a diamond in the sun. It just looks at each side of this theme over and over and over again. And Pharoah Sanders eventually comes in and starts to build lines out of this theme. And then the orchestra arrives. And it is an incredibly energizing but extremely relaxing experience to listen to this music. And it's not like anything else out there right now. Highly recommended. We'll play you a little bit as we go out. Floating Points and Pharoah Sanders. And the album's called Promises. That's it for another week of Soft Revolution. Join us next week. We can't wait to hear and talk and see you again. Stay safe. Get your vaccine. If it's there, don't go through a moral conundrum. Just fucking go down there and get it. And then write down all the things you lost and then burn that and then start a new project and tell us about it. We're going to do this, people. We've got a summer coming up. We can do this. Stay strong. Love you.
Love you.
Thank you. Thank you.